The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy of Lectromech, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have the world famous Dave Mihelsik. Federal Chief Technology and Strategy Officer at Juniper Networks. Although most people know him from other occupations he's had in the last 20 years, putting a big impact on the IT community here in Washington, D.C. Dave, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate you coming down here.
Well, thanks for inviting me today, and I'm very glad for that introduction.
I was talking to some of the people in the studio, and I said, hey, maybe Dave will sign autographs after the radio interview. Because, I mean, you're pretty well known in town here. I think what you're known for is people handing you a tough plate and you figuring out how to solve problems. And we can go through the next 40 minutes and talk about some of the things that were dumped on your lap and how you figured out how to do it. But tell me about your background, maybe your education background, and how you even wound up working for the federal government a few years back.
So I'm an engineer. I went to the University of Illinois and got my degree in electrical engineering. And while I was there, I spent 2 years in Naval ROTC. I spent a summer on a nuclear submarine. And although I really had a profound love for the Navy and its mission, I decided I didn't want to spend the next 6 years of my life underwater. So instead of continuing in the program and accepting a commission, I went to work for the Navy as a civilian engineer. And I spent many years with a place called the Naval Research Laboratory. And among other things, we essentially invented what really is modern cybersecurity. At the time I started, we really focused on communication security, how to encrypt the voice and data links that went to and from our Navy combatants. And we started looking at concepts of how we could use those data links to interconnect computers. And as we did that, we determined that it was actually as important to secure those computers on the network as it was to secure the network links between the ships.
Perfect background for the next 30 years, I'd say. I mean, this is, hey, front page news today. What you
Absolutely.
Started at, what, 25, 30 years ago, huh?
25 years ago. In fact, I started the Navy's firewall program in the mid-90s. We used, at the time, open source software and open source operating systems, commercial routers. We built them by hand and deployed them globally.
The big old circle comes back, huh? All that stuff you learned years ago is coming back to be talked about today. So, tell us about DISA, how you wound up at DISA, and how that all happened. The listener should know he has a very strong career at DISA. Tell us about your career, please.
So I was actually doing commercial consulting at the time, and I was in an oil refinery in Ponca City, Oklahoma.
I was in Oklahoma last week.
Well, this was a few years ago. I got a call from my old friend Richard Hale, who was in charge of, at the time, information security development at DISA, and Don Hartley, now Don Myricks, who was in charge of command and control development at DISA. And they said, we have a job you might be interested in. And I applied for the job, and sort of the rest is history. One day I got a call from Colonel Frank Whitehead, and he said, I'm the chief of staff at DISA, and my boss, Dave Kelly, would like to offer you a job, but he's not going to call you until you guarantee me you're going to say yes. And I said, well, Colonel, I applied for this job in a moment of weakness. I'm not sure I want to go back into the federal government. I only escaped about a year ago. And he said, I can guarantee you we can't pay you as much as you're earning in industry, but I'll guarantee you can have a positive impact on the Department of Defense. You can really help the warfighter. So
there
based on that, I said, I'll take the job. And Lieutenant General Kelly called and offered me the job. And I spent the next 19 years of my career with the Defense Information Systems Agency, initially as a chief of command and control development, working for Don Myricks, later as the head of network engineering, and then finally as the chief technology officer.
My. The chief technology officer for an organization that works with the military branch. Not a lot of room for failure in there, is there? There's not a lot of room for oops.
No, absolutely. DISA's missions are mission critical. We support the president, the combatant commanders, the military services, and all of those who support those organizations. So our mission, DISA's mission, is global. The reach extends everywhere that the United States Department of Defense operates, which is subsea, surface, across the globe and into space. And DISA needs to be there.
If you go to your LinkedIn profile, the three top skills listed are information assurance, security, and integration. Pretty good summary of your background, isn't it? Yeah, that's a nice
like
generic type summary. Yeah, that's really good. So after many years in the federal government, we can talk a little about that. You decided to switch, and now you're working for Juniper Networks. Tell us about Juniper and why you picked them, please.
So Juniper Networks is a leading technology organization that really builds the technology that runs the internet. Core routing and switching, cloud data center switching, campus and enterprise switching, security technology, and now most recently, software-defined networking and cloud computing technology. And what attracted me to Juniper Networks was a number of years ago, I was the head of engineering for a program called the Global Information Grid Bandwidth Expansion. And we had funding to increase the amount of bandwidth available to the DoD by orders of magnitude, 10, 100 times. And to do that, we had to get the leading edge networking gear that was available at the time. And we put out an open competition for everything from fiber optic cable to dense wave division multiplexing gear to IP routers. And it turned out that this brand new company called Juniper Networks won the competition for the IP routers because they had certain innovations that no one else in the world did at that point.
Mid-90s.
Late 90s, early 2000s at that point. So we were able to acquire this technology, integrate it on schedule and in budget, and deliver a global network to nearly 100 locations that the DoD operates out of. And we increased the bandwidth by many orders of magnitude. We went from, in many cases, 45 megabits per second to 1.8 terabits per second. So really revolutionized communication for the Department of Defense. And part of that success was due to technology that we acquired from Juniper Networks. So a few years later, actually just this past year when I was considering retirement, Juniper Networks was one of those companies that I really had an affinity for because of the great technology and support they'd provided us over the years.
Now, I'll admit, when I think of Juniper, I think of hardware. However, in doing my show prep, what I learned is that 80% of the engineers at Juniper are software developers. What? So, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I never – who'd have thunk it?
So absolutely, right? I think Mark Andreessen said software is going to eat the world, and he's absolutely right. So while we do need a base of high-performance hardware, in some cases specialized to certain applications like being able to move internet packets quickly – it's all software driven. So software is the key to our strategy moving forward. Not only do we need to provide the software on these purpose-built devices, but we're also disaggregating that software so it can run on more general purpose hardware. And Juniper software can accomplish the mission, whether it's on a dedicated custom router at the core of the internet or a edge PC that happens to run a virtual router or switch.
And another fascinating fact, so I always look at the last 100 tweets from everyone I interview because I'm pretty compulsive. What's interesting is the tweets, you know, here's a tweet from you guys, actionable insights. Well, so wait a minute. I thought this was a router, switcher, firewall company. No, I think the tool may be a piece of hardware or software, but the goal is actionable insights. That's the innovation for me.
Right. The network as a sensor. If you deploy a network, every piece of gear in that network is potentially a sensor that can help you understand your cybersecurity posture, to help you defeat cybersecurity threats, to help you optimize performance, to help you ensure that that network performs optimally and meets your customer requirement.
I think it's obvious that the transition that's taking place now is moving to the cloud, and I think Juniper has a key role in that. And what I'd like to do is maybe take a break here, and then when we come back, I want to get some more insights on your career at DISA. I want to talk about collaboration, and I want to talk about maybe geographic moves, and I want to talk about move to the cloud and maybe lessons learned from both. I mean, a lot of transitions here. The parallel that comes up is going from Virginia to Maryland, going from behind the firewall to the cloud, and maybe there's some lessons learned in all these things, especially involving collaboration. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Dave Mihelsik, Federal Chief Technology and Strategy Officer at Juniper Networks. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, We got the big dog himself, Dave Mihalcik, Federal Chief Technology and Strategy Officer, Juniper Networks. And he's talking about some of his experience in the federal government, talking about Juniper. And, you know, I've done 510 shows, Dave. And I'll tell you what, in the last probably 200 shows, the word that pops up a lot is collaboration, and I can't do this alone, and I got to get a cloud, and how can we secure? And you don't understand. We have to securely – you don't understand. It's not like working for Dunkin' Donuts, and we got to collaborate, but hands are tied. But you've been in situations where the only way you'd survive is by collaboration, and you were in a ridiculously tight environment. And so how did you collaborate and still remain secure at the same time in these incredible projects you handled?
So collaboration and, you know, the definition of collaboration is really working together. It's essential to everything the Department of Defense does. And strangely enough, at DISA, we very narrowly defined collaboration tools as, say, web conferencing or video teleconferencing. But the reality is collaboration is about ensuring that you have the support to military operations so that they can work together to deliver whatever the intended effect is, whether it's humanitarian operations or whether it's an offensive against an enemy of national security. You have to provide the warfighter with the tools. It starts with secure networking, being able to interconnect not just the fixed locations, the military operating bases such as the Pentagon or the major service operating bases, but also our forward deployed units, our ships, our aircraft, and our even dismounted warfighters. So we got to provide secure networking. And then on top of that, we have to provide applications and tools so that they have whatever is required to accomplish their mission. Some of those are going to be commercially based. And, a great example of a collaboration tool that we probably are all aware of is email, but there's lots of others out there. And then the DoD has very specialized applications for collaboration, command and control systems, like the Global Command and Control System, that allow commanders who are geographically dispersed to make decisions that are coordinated and then get those decisions executed.
You know, secure network, it's nice to sit here and in an air-conditioned room, you got a coffee, I got a coffee, we're having a chat about this. But if you think what a warfighter's position is, in a forward position, you may have people from NGOs, intelligence, civilians, different branches all in one place, and they have to securely communicate. And this can be in difficult environments. And so, putting this in a piece of paper is one thing, but doing it, that's really the hard part, isn't it? I mean, we can put this in a whiteboard till we're silly, but someone's out there in his life is dependent on a secure communication and could be three or four different people, and how do you authenticate? And that's tough.
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends on the situation you're in. So one secure collaboration might be highly cleared members of the U.S. intelligence community working with the Department of Defense. Another collaboration might be us interacting with non-governmental organizations, NGOs, where the actual people involved don't even have a security clearance. And we've got to be able to support all those. And really, it's about not just technology, but our forward deployed operators having the flexibility to set up those networks and set up the information technology required to accomplish the mission they've been given.
I went to your Twitter feed. And
it hasn't been used in a while.
I know, but you have a great quote in there. It says, you're in a quest to drive innovation in a world of caution. Not bad, huh?
Well, unfortunately, the Department of Defense and the federal government writ large is, by definition, a cautious, conservative organization.
I hope so.
On the other hand, sometimes you got to take some risks, calculated risks. But without risks, where would we be today? Would we have the internet? Would we have smartphones? Would we have the cloud? It's all about taking calculated risks.
So let's take this little quote on innovation and apply it to the federal government. So what does innovation look like for government agencies who are trying to modernize their networks?
So what innovation looks like for government organizations trying to modernize their networks is to look to industry, to look to best commercial practices, and try to follow those, once again, as best you can. It is going to imply taking some risk, but it's going to imply adopting technologies such as the Internet Protocol, which thankfully, I don't think anybody questions at this point. But, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago, there was hesitance in the Department of Defense. We still had people who said we have to stick with legacy TDM, time division multiplexing technology. Internet protocol isn't secure. Now, fortunately, I work for an organization like DISA, which was advocating the Internet protocol, you know, even 30 years ago. Moving ahead, cloud computing is another example of a best commercial technology that the federal government has to adopt because it allows you to scale rapidly, to scale massively, and be able to deliver services required when they're required. And I can go on and on, just a couple of examples.
Years ago, I really studied VOIP, and that's where I learned about time division multiplex. And it's the first time I've heard TDM in about 8 years. I mean, wow, TDM, someone knows what that means.
So it's funny. When I came into DISA in 1999, voice over IP was brand new, and we had a particular combatant commander, SOCOM, United States Special Operations Command, that was deploying voice over IP tactically. So to their forward deployed units. And DISA was pushing back on it because they said it's not secure, it's not interoperable with our legacy TDM-based systems. And one of my first assignments was to sort of mediate that dispute. And what we eventually ended up with is a way to securely interface their forward-deployed tactical voice over IP networks to our sustaining base TDM systems. And then a few years later, when we saw the utility of voice over IP, and really, once again, the utility was the agility to be able to rapidly deploy to have reduce the kit that warfighters had to take forward significantly so they could, not only be cheaper, but, more agile and more mobile. We decided to implement VoIP for the entire Department of Defense. And we immediately got pushback from the Pentagon because the folks who did program analysis in the Pentagon said there's no requirement for voice over IP. And it actually took a number of years to convince them that it wasn't necessarily a new requirement, that this was just the evolution of voice. And if the DoD didn't go this route, in a few years, we'd be unable to buy legacy telephony. And sure enough, that's come to fore. No one makes legacy telephony anymore. It's all voice over IP.
We're going to have Hughes Networks in the studio here in a couple of weeks. We're going to talk about satellites. And satellites go RF to IP. You did TDM to IP. That is just what's going to happen. You can like it or lump it, but that's what's
turns
happening.
Turns out DISA was actually a pioneer in IP over SATCOM as well. Once again, in the late 90s, we had a technology pioneer, a gentleman named Bruce Bennett. And Bruce modernized the system that we used to downlink video from UAVs. And the way he did that was he adopted IP-based SATCOM technology, and it turned out it's the same technology that companies like Hughes and the DirecTV and Dish Network, EchoStar, were using to get programming down to your set-top box. They'd move to the IP protocol over SATCOM. So Bruce identified this technology and actually incorporated it into our DoD networks and revolutionized the distribution of video to the warfighter.
That is a story I want to pursue more. I think people don't realize, where's Ponca City? Get out your phone. And you're driving in your car, and you know where Ponca City is and gives you left by right. And how did that happen? Well, guess what? Probably some guy over at DISA beat his head against the wall for several years and argued with people in order to have some idea that may or may – and all of a sudden, we have instant directions everywhere in the United States. It's incredible what's happened with small innovation like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Precision timing and navigation, grew out of Air Force and Navy work in the 50s and 60s and eventually realized the global positioning system that really is now the key to precision navigation. We take it for granted that you can find directions from anywhere to anywhere by pulling out your phone. But 30 years ago, that was not the way it worked. We had maps. Kids, look it up. We used to all have glove compartments full of maps.
I was at a Tableau conference. I was a master of ceremonies, and I said, give me a show of hands. How many people use visualizations for finance? Yeah. How many people visualizations for big data? Yeah. How many people for geospatial? I had 25% geospatial, and I'm sure that would not have happened 5 years ago. Geospatial is very popular in so many areas, probably because of breakthroughs from this little-known guy who figured out they can do IP or VOP. They can do ever SATCOM, which is a challenge, just to say. I mean, there's a lot of things going on up there that people
right.
don't realize there. Good, good, good. Well, let's take a little break. We come back. I think I'm going to talk about more of Juniper, where it fits in. The transition, I think, that Juniper's making, unless I'm mistaken, they're making a transition more to services. And another thing I learned in doing research is that Juniper puts like 25% of its annual budget in R&D. I mean, these are fun facts that are going to get you on Jeopardy, but maybe you know them, but I don't know them, and maybe the listeners can learn about Juniper's innovations as well. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're speaking with Dave Mihalcik, Chief Technology and Strategy Officer, Juniper Networks. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Dave Mihalcik, Federal Chief Technology and Strategy Officer at Juniper Networks. Many, many, many of my listeners know about Dave's work at DISA. And I think most listeners know that DISA has gone under some significant transitions. When Dave was out there, they moved from Arlington to somewhere in Maryland. And I'm trying to draw parallels here between geographically moving and moving to the cloud. And I'm coming up with something here. I got to bounce around with something. But what I'm thinking of is getting the most bang for the buck and being efficient about that move and how to be most efficient. And I'll tell you my efficiency story. I have a daughter who's living in Norfolk. And my wife said, well, let's take a weekend in July and just go down to Virginia Beach and see Brittany. I said, whoa. See Brittany, you go to the beach. I was very, very efficient with that little dollar spent on vacation, convenient local. So I got the most bang out of my buck for my vacation. So let's apply that to Juniper and the federal government. What about bang for the buck? And give us advice. Someone from DOI Interior calls you and goes, oh, Dave, what's the most bang for my buck for my IT spend? How do you do that?
Well, you know, the first thing I tell them is make sure you're basing your acquisitions on open standards and make sure you make your acquisitions competitive. Too often, government organizations either sole source or go to a single vendor. And when you do that, by definition, you're not going to get the best return on your investment. When you have industry competing with industry, you're going to get better pricing. And in fact, if you talk to people who work for the carriers, the telcos, or the cloud providers, they use competition to beat down pricing across the board. So open standards and competition. The next point that I'd make is automation. By automating your IT infrastructure, you can reduce your operations and maintenance costs by reducing the personnel required, by reducing downtime, and increasing efficiency of services you deliver to your stakeholders, either the public or your internal stakeholders. So focusing on automation based on open standards are really keys.
You know, Loudoun County is full of brilliant IT people, and no one knows it. And one of the brilliant people that lives in Loudoun County is a guy named Dave Linthicum. Written 13 books, writes for InfoWorld, has a podcast. Everyone knows he's real smart. He has all kinds of insights, public speaker. This morning, he published an article in InfoWorld, and he said, hey, you know, the cloud is really safer than something behind the firewall here. And I said, well, geez, I don't know. I mean, that sounds like a strange statement. So given that statement, the cloud is safer because of automation? Or what do you think he's trying to argue here? How would you respond if you were sitting in a coffee shop with Dave and said, Dave versus Dave? Ooh, that would be a good podcast, wouldn't it?
I'm looking forward to that one.
Dave versus Dave. What do you think about the cloud being more secure?
So I think the cloud is potentially significantly more secure than traditional IT. And, you know, I'll give you a few reasons for that. Traditional IT has been run in a manner sometimes where it's not as reliable and robust. You have applications that reside on a single set of servers, and either a power event or an operator management error can take that down. So if you move from that single physical location into the cloud, and you can acquire cloud-based services in geographically distinct regions so that you have higher availability, you can completely reduce those reliability and operational risks associated with deploying those applications. Secondly, the cloud providers, if their clouds are going to run at all, they have to be designed with security in mind upfront. So multi-tenancy in particular, being able to separate one customer from another is essential, because if they couldn't do that, the system wouldn't operate if one customer inadvertently got into another customer's virtual data center. So by definition, they're investing huge resources in providing a virtualized secure infrastructure and from keeping one customer separate from another customer and keeping all customers out of their management infrastructure. So All that being said, then it's incumbent upon you as a IT professional to leverage those cloud services appropriately. So if you're using infrastructure as a service, where you're just buying essentially virtualized compute from a company like Amazon or Microsoft or Google, you still have to build and secure your IT within it. They're not going to worry about securing your workload. That'll be your problem. But if you move up the stack to software as a service, those cloud providers take on more and more of the security burden. And what becomes really important then is to understand the service level agreement that they're providing, to understand what they take care of and what you still have to take care of. And this is one reason why the federal government came up with FedRAMP, to evaluate the implementations and the service level agreements in a very common way, so that federal organizations would understand what they're getting, what the cloud provider does and does not do, and then what's left for them to do.
Now, years ago, when I was taking all my VOIP tests, I had learned SLA and TD, and those were applied years ago, but SLA is still with us in many different applications. When I would go to Google and I type in Dave, M-I-H-E-L-C-I-C, it'll autocomplete things. And it may autocomplete forge.mil.
I bet you it will.
I bet you it will. So why would your name be associated with forge.mil?
So a number of years ago, we were looking at the problem of how to build software better, how to enable collaboration in the Department of Defense. So we came up with the concept of, at the time, looking at really the embryonic cloud-based collaboration services as SourceForge that existed in the internet at the time, and said, how can we provide the DoD a version of that that is open and yet secure, so that we can build software that could be shared with anybody on the internet, but also could be compartmented. So if there was something sensitive about it, or if we wanted to maintain a pedigree of that software, we could do that in a secure fashion. So we basically adopted open source and commercial software. We integrated it on DoD data centers at the time, because cloud was still in its infancy at that point, and secured that with DoD access control techniques, and provided a platform for collaborative software development that could be used by anyone in the Department of Defense or the intelligence community. And that was Forge.mil. And really, Forge.mil jump-started this notion of DoD organizations being able to collaborate, work together, to build software, to deliver software much more quickly and more reliably than if they did it in stovepipes.
Okay, we're in the Jeopardy today. We have another one. Another quick category is mil.cloud. Tell me about mil.cloud. That's associated with you too.
Actually, MilCloud, or we originally wanted the URL cloud.mil.
Ah.
Unfortunately, the Army had already taken it, so we said, well, maybe we'll just call it MilCloud instead.
Yeah.
So really, that was our approach to trying to provide a private cloud for the Department of Defense. And the reason we did that is, once again, the DoD is a little bit conservative. And initially, we were skeptical of some of the security claims of the early cloud providers. And now we're talking about perhaps the year 2011, 2012. So we said, can we put in place a private cloud? Can we leverage commercial technology and integrate that and put it in a DoD data center, connect it to our network, and control who can have access to it? So the initial version of that, MilCloud, was fielded, I think, in about the year 2012. We went operational with the first version of MilCloud. We immediately onboarded hundreds of customers from the Department of Defense, because it had a very streamlined approach to provisioning, where you went to a web portal. A DoD user could get a quick estimate of what it would cost to provision a particular workload in MilCloud. They would then transfer funding to DISA, and that would be provisioned essentially on demand. Not quite as quickly as merely a click on a button, but nearly as quickly. So we were able to take the time to provision customers in a DoD data center down from months or weeks to hours. Highly successful.
Let me read between the lines here. And this is what people are listening. They're going, well, okay, now, if you were to do that with Ford Motor Company, that'd be difficult to do. Or if you do that with Walmart, that may be due to. But you're dealing with some very demanding people. And if there's any issues or problems, That Dave's name would have been the front page of the Washington Post. Hey, this guy Dave Mihelsik, he screwed up, and we trusted our important military stuff. But I didn't see your name in the front page of the Washington Post. Now, did I, Dave? I don't think so.
No, as a government employee, your number one objective in your career is to stay off of the Washington Post front page. And fortunately, in my career, I passed that test.
Yeah, well, you sure did, and I think everyone knows it. And that's why having the studio to say, well, how did you do this collaboration? What tools did you use? What did you avoid? And you make this transition to Juniper, and what role does Juniper have in making this transition to the cloud, public, private, hybrid, how to choose different specifications, who to work with, and all kinds of new things, especially with the services that are offered from Juniper. Let's take a break, come back, and we'll talk about crystal ball, where's the future for the federal government, maybe touch on cybersecurity, networking, and I like this whole concept of collaboration, because I don't think anyone's got all the answers, and you know, you get 15 or 20 people together, you know, that's the best way I can conceive of making these difficult transitions, because there's just too many things to know and too many different sets of talents in order to make these transitions. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM in our studio. Dave Mihelsik, Federal Chief Technology and Strategy Officer at Juniper Networks. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Dave Mihelsik, Chief Technology and Strategy Officer at Juniper Networks. And I want to say CTO at DISA, but I didn't say that. But most people know him from his work at DISA. A lot of big changes, a lot of successes, a lot of opportunities to fail, Dave. I mean, I could have been reporting a lot of Dave's failures over the last few years, but not a lot of successes. And we touched on some topics earlier. We talked about automation and networks and secure networking and innovation in the world of caution. And I got to talk about cybersecurity because it's in the front page news. You know, you walk down the street skywriting cybersecurity problems. So what the heck does networks and automation and cybersecurity, is this a good brew or what's going on here?
So cybersecurity has been important to the Department of Defense and the federal government, you know, since the beginning of computing and networking. I think the rest of the world is starting to wake up to how important cybersecurity is. You know, some of the recent hacks, to include what we saw, the non-ransomware hack that was apparently directed against Ukraine, as well as the recent ransomware WannaCry attack. So we're all very sensitized to cybersecurity. All that being said, I think that some of the traditional approaches to cybersecurity of physically separate networks and simply trying to use a firewall to provide security are not sufficient. So moving forward, I think we need to take a different approach to software security. We need to use the entire network, everything from the routers to the edge switches to the servers and PCs themselves to secure the network. And that's going to require us to gather data or telemetry from all of the network elements and from the end compute elements, use big data analytics to try to detect attacks. And when we do, implement security mechanisms, not on a single firewall, but on that firewall and on the routers and on the switching and on the end compute themselves. In Juniper, we actually have a term for that, and that's the software-defined secure network.
I saw a tweet with that earlier. It was talking about VXLANs, virtual extensible LANs. And again, I went to your Twitter feed and I'm looking for hardware. I'm seeing the ONAP project, Python, Junos OS, Shift to the Cloud, and Actionable Insights. And that's where Juniper's heading.
Right. So, and really, this is the link between networking, cybersecurity, and automation. We have techniques and products that can detect cyber attacks, something called Sky Advanced Threat Prevention or Sky ATP. That's a cloud-based service that can detect a potential malware or cyber attack against an enterprise's infrastructure. It can then push knowledge of that attack down to the network, and then security mechanisms are put in place, not just at the boundary firewall, but in the routers and switches, and even collaborating with other software providers in security mechanisms found on the NPCs and servers.
Baked into the network instead
Absolutely.
Of added on or bolted on.
And recognizing that you can't have a single point of threat detection and prevention. It's got to be defense in depth.
We started off this interview, and we talked about your education in Illinois and your EE work and then the Naval Lab, and we talked about VOIP, and things have changed over the years. And I'm going to have you put on your smarty pants hat and say, okay, big fella, give me a 5 to 7 year projection here on what's going to happen in terms of networking and cybersecurity and cloud deployment and risks and the reluctance for many agencies to make this move. And let's face it, there are some institutional challenges here in making this transition, aren't there? So give me a prediction here, Dave.
So my prediction is we're going to move from an era of technology, innovation, and technology disruption. And when I say disruption, I'm talking about a positive sense. Companies like Netflix and Spotify use technology to completely disrupt the entertainment industry. Uber and Lyft have completely disrupted the transportation industry. Airbnb has completely disrupted the lodging and hotel industry, and they did that all with technology. So we're going to move from an area where a very few number of companies use technology to disrupt industries to a large number of companies are going to be able to affect massive change in daily lives. And this is a concept that instead of digital disruption, we like to, at Juniper, refer to it as digital cohesion, where we're going to try to bring together applications that will automatically connect and self-assemble into compelling mega services that are going to enhance people's lives in ways that we have yet to anticipate.
Let's go back to the future, back to 1996. The founders of Juniper, a bunch of smart guys got together and competed against a bigger company. And they were known for being the challenger and being the disruptor. That's what Juniper had on their – they might have had the – remember when Steve Jobs had the pirate flag above his building? Well, they might as well take that pirate flag and put it at Juniper, because they were just young kids, startups, had a good idea, thought they could do something better than the big dog, and they kind of won a lot of business that way. So here it is 20 years later. They've got to go back to be the challenger. They have to have the challenger mode. They have to have the disruptor mode.
Right, absolutely. And some of these concepts like digital cohesion and how Juniper can support that through the software-defined secure network, network automation, as well as network performance, being able to increase bandwidth at ever and ever growing rates and at the same time reduce latency and reduce downtime at the network are essential. And that's our key discriminator.
I deal with a lot of students, and students are getting degrees and certifications. And, I just want to ask you your opinion of some certifications. CISSP, you think it's watered down? You think it's as valuable as it was a few years back?
Unfortunately, I believe it is watered down. It's a credential, but it's not necessarily a qualification. So,
I want to quote that. That's in my next tweet. It's a credential, but not a qualification.
Right. So really,
we're
looking for people with the academic background or the training. They don't necessarily have to have a formal degree, but they have to have had training and experience. And that can cover both cybersecurity in terms of a CISSP or in software development, skills in a particular programming language or a particular software engineering technique. So we need that training and education as well as real-world experience. And unfortunately, you can't get that in a 5-day boot camp that's essentially cramming for an exam.
You know, you really can't. You need someone who really has to be like a hobby or an avocation or something they enjoy doing. And oh, by the way, oh, yeah, it's almost a talent or a skill that's built in, I think.
Well, absolutely. And for better or worse, the military is becoming a training ground for our next generation of cybersecurity operators that are going to flow into industry because through what CyberCom has done in standing up the cyber forces of the Department of Defense, the cyber protection teams, they are taking kids out of high school. They're putting them through formal development and education programs, and then they're getting on-the-job training from experienced cybersecurity professionals and how to not only defend the network, but also how to hunt for adversaries within the network. And these kind of skills are going to be essential in industry. So I think that what we're going to see is an outflow of veterans of our cyber protection teams in the Department of Defense into industry. So if you really want to learn cybersecurity, consider the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, or Coast Guard.
And that's great advice. I think of 20, 30 years ago, high school star athletes would go into the Marine Corps or the Naval Academy. Now I think gamers, I think if the federal government can somehow attract gamers and put them in a position to learn, and they have the native skill set, they have the weightlifting ability and speed and intellectual capability to handle. You know, they talk about drone training and looking at gamers of all the people in the world, and if you can attract that skill set, it would be wonderful.
So absolutely, gamers and developers, right? A lot of kids in high school have programming experience and expertise that they develop through their coursework and just through their hobbies. And those are going to be our next generation of experts.
When it comes to Juniper, where do you think they're going to be in the next 5 to 10 years?
So we're going to continue to lead in terms of performance of our hardware, but we're also going to lead in terms of our software, and we're going to see disaggregation of that software, where Juniper software is going to run not just on our special purpose hardware, but is going to run in the commercial cloud with technologies such as our virtual SRX or firewall, or our virtual MX or high performance router that can run in commercial clouds as well as local virtualized infrastructures. You know, within your post-campus station in terms of the military or potentially even your home. So we're going to see Juniper everywhere.
Disaggregation. Are you an EE or an English major? Let me look at this degree you have here. Disaggregation, that's kind of a fancy word, isn't
it? Well, you know, engineers are, you know, by definition, you know, well-versed in communication skills.
Well, I think they are. They're real good. My name is John Gilroy, and I just do this show once a week. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Ray Gilray. And if you want to go to my company site, I'm at theoakmontgroupllc.com for more information on what I do. I help tech companies grow. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dave Mihalcik, Chief Technology and Strategy Officer from Juniper Networks. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. If you miss any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.